This podcast has been sponsored in loving memory of Charles Foyer, Bezalel Avraham. To learn more about how to sponsor a podcast, please contact Jamie at jamie@pardes.org.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit lmod.pardes.org.
As always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, pardes.org.il, for helping to make this class happen. Okay, everybody, good morning. How are we doing? So we left off, as I now recall with Avram's help, at the end of the story of the Hasidei Ashkenaz. And we're in this very rich time period of the 13th century, like the high Middle Ages in non-Jewish history, although it's about at the tipping point, frankly, there. You might be actually already into the late Middle Ages. But for our purposes, it's an incredibly rich time of development in Jewish thought and culture. Right? We've already put into place the work that Rashi really finishes in many ways, and that element of Torah learning, which was about consolidation and clarification, whether it's in his work in the Chumash, in our ability to read the Chumash as its story, which isn't just the written Torah and the oral Torah fused, which is a lot of what Rashi does, but in my approach, actually makes the current reader yet another layer in the text. If you recall, that was my argument of why Rashi becomes sometimes a moralist and educator as opposed to just a parshan, just an elucidator of the text. So we have that whole stream of thought, and it's not going to go away, right? To this very day, there are elements within Am Yisrael who think that the purpose is simply to understand and apply, right? We have also the Tosfos, who were the ones, by reintroducing the dialectic, which had been the primary tool of the Gemara, of the Amoraim, remembering that that's those tools of collation, contradiction, and distinction, right? That they broke the mold of the finite, well-ordered universe of the Gemara and made it into an expanding and essentially infinite universe, right? They're still asking new questions today, right? And we will see that play itself out, not so much today in our story, but we'll see it play itself out in Ashkenazi culture in general and Torah learning in particular as we go into early modernity, should we get there together this year. We'll get there someday. And we also spoke about the Tosfos as a new model of leadership, right? That they really, that sort of crucible of the Crusades within which Ashkenazi rabbinic leadership, the model of sort of, if not charismatic in the personal sense, but intellectually charismatic leadership. If you recall, that was the martyrdom. If it was worth it for them to die for, it's worth it for me to live for. For the Tosfos really supply the living examples of that rabbinic leadership, really to this very day. They represent kind of the height within Ashkenazi culture of what rabbinic leadership should be. Whether that is still relevant to the people they're trying to lead right now is an important question. And then the last piece that we put into place was last week proper, which is Hasidei Ashkenaz. Right, these early pietists of the 13th century Ashkenaz, who we said that really what they were struggling with was very similar to the Tosfos, is that the world was suddenly a very big place, as opposed to the sort of ancient, or let's say late antiquity world, within which most of the Midrash was formulated, which was, okay, it wasn't exactly well known, but at least it was orderly, and there were categories of human experience, and there were broad sort of theological understandings about the nature of humanity and the relationship between God and creation. The models that they had inherited from the Midrash no longer seemed so relevant in the 12th and 13th centuries when European culture was expanding rapidly, both physically in an early age of exploration, also economically and socially, intellectually. And so therefore, they were seeking the Ratzon HaBoreh. Right? They were seeking that will of the Creator, which was undefined by the written and oral Torah. If you remember, that was that sort of Venn diagram I drew up on the board where they were pietists. They weren't looking to do something other than the law. They were looking to do something beyond the letter of the law. So they felt that you had to have a mastery of the law in order to then head out into the great unknown of life experience and figure out what God wants from you. Right? And in the moral sense, remember we saw that had a few elements. One was, they really were really into making a siyag Torah, into making fences around the Torah, because not only did they feel that there were all kinds of demands which were being made, which they may not know, and as I pointed out to you, is that you really need a fence on the edge of a cliff when you don't know exactly where the edge is, right? They also had a sense that they were going to be, that ignorance is no excuse, right? Just because you didn't know what God's will was at a particular moment doesn't mean you're not going to be held accountable, in which case you ought to be very cautious in general in what you do, lest you suddenly discover that it was inappropriate, right? And the last piece, which is always worth remembering, was this sort of moralist stance of action in the line of most resistance. That the real field of play for avodat Hashem, for divine service, was in the mastery of the inner human life. And therefore, the more one focuses on overcoming desire, overcoming what we would call the evil inclination, right? The resistance that we feel itself is not just a barrier to performing the divine will. It's actually a means of performing divine will by overcoming it, right? That was that example I gave you with the Umshin of a Rebbe, you know, sitting for a half hour before making Kiddush on Pesach night because, of course, he hadn't eaten, and God forbid you should make a bracha because you're hungry. You make a bracha because you want to serve God. And you only eat because you want to serve God. Some people struck them as quite inhuman, which I can understand, right? But it does need to be considered. This idea where there are kind of two dangers of dualism that we're actually going to see both of them crop up in our story today, which are always good to keep on the page. One is body and spirit, right? This whole question of where is it that God resides? Is God's primary will expressed in the Torah and the laws, which would mean that the emphasis is on mind and spirit, right? Or is there another aspect of equally important action through physical, and by the way, the mitzvot make a bridge between the two. Right? There are certain mitzvot which are sort of more of the esoteric inner state, saying kriyat shema, laying tefillin, even though it's a physical act, it's about the intentionality. Right? But eating matzah on Pesach is about as physical as it gets. Right? That's one of my favorite moments of the year. Everybody goes silent and you just hear... It's so holy. Plus, you spent your entire week cleaning your house, and now, within 5 seconds, it's covered in crumbs, right? It's the great irony. Anyway, so that's one dualism, this question of the physical and spiritual, and where exactly does the emphasis of divine service belong? And if we stick together long enough over the coming years to get to Zionism, so you'll understand there's very important shifts in Ashkenazi culture that happen specifically around that question within the Zionist movement, right? The other side, which is perhaps more relevant for our story today, is the struggle between reason and revelation. This question of whether the human being on their own, as we'd say, qua human being, as a rational creature, can actually achieve truth and sort of therefore right meaning and proper service of God, or whether that is purely the province of revelation, and the human being on their own at best can supplement and at worst can only deceive themselves. Right? And these are important questions for Jewish history as well as for general world history, and we're going to get into them today. So that's just in terms of a little bit of setting the stage for the next element of the 13th century, because we're still really in the early 13th century. Questions or comments before what we're going to talk about today, just to get the big picture, is I want to introduce the resurgent papacy, because the Catholic Church is going to take an ever-increasing role in a sort of a combative sense with Am Yisrael at this point in the Middle Ages. And in that light, I want to go into the Jews of Provence, a very important place in Jewish history that unfortunately a lot of us don't know so much about, right? And you could say that it's Ashkenazi or Sephardi, so it serves as a bridge. It's actually neither, right? And last but certainly not least, the great Rambam controversy, which I think we'll draw all those pieces together.
Just a quick question, because you mentioned about the physical and spiritual and the historical setting. To what extent was there an impact of the Cathar heresy?
So, to what extent the Cathar heresy plays is exactly what we're going to speak about today.
You are.
Oh yes. We're gonna get there in Provence. That is the Albigensian Crusade is the center of our story today. Other questions? Yeah.
Alvaro. I know that the Hasidim in the 18th century are not the same as these Hasidim Ashkenaz, but I think of the Gardel as an example. When a modern Hasid, I don't know, in the 3rd century they did that. But one of the reasons they're wearing that is to try to, to separate, right, spiritual
from the physical. The Gartel as an example of, it's an emblem of the Hasidim, and it is also, you're absolutely correct, an attempt to separate, I mean, truth of the matter is, separate different aspects of the physical even, But interestingly enough, what's the origin? Do people know what a gartel is? It's a, like those prayer belt. It's like often a, like a cloth belt you often see some people will pull out of their pocket and put on when they pray, wrap it a few times. It looks, it's much associated, like Avram's pointing out, with the Hasidic movement of the 18th and 19th century. But its origins? Anybody? Well, the Gemara says that you're required to have a division between your heart and your nakedness, so to speak. Remembering in late antiquity, people wore like, you know, one-piece robe, tunics often was a common clothing. So therefore, if you were wearing a full robe and you weren't wearing an underwear, so like you're all naked under there, right? So so the Gemara says you have to make a separation. But it's important to remember that the Bavli in particular was written in the midst of Persian culture, right? Babylonian Persian culture. And the Persians were dualists. They were dualists, Zoroastrians, and therefore, they specifically designated certain organs as belonging to the lower evil world, and those basically below your diaphragm, digestive, reproductive, physical oriented, and the upper organs, lungs, heart, mind, were, and so there are a lot of questions in terms of where that dualism creeps in to Jewish culture from Zoroastrian, where, by the way, it might have gone into Zoroastrian from Jewish culture. It's always hard to know who's giving and who's receiving. Also, like we've said before, and this is going to come up in our story, is that it's the monotheists who chose a hard life in terms of theology. If you're a dualist or a polytheist, everything makes perfect sense, right? Evil, simple to explain, right? The problems of suffering, no big deal, blame it on the devil, right? Our good God, it just happens to be elsewhere. And we're going to see in the Cathars and the whole Albigensian story that plays a very important role.
But we're supposed to be monotheists.
We are monotheists. Because, you listen, to be a pure monotheist, I think is a, what? First of all, for sure, that's actually the best answer. It's what we do. And that's an important answer. No, it's an important answer. Is that Judaism is an organic outgrowth of real people. It is also a sort of philosophical and perhaps even revealed religion, but it is also an organic outgrowth of a historical process. So on some level, minhag, when we say minhag Yisrael Torahi, that the custom of what the Jews do is the Torah, so that's probably the best answer. The other is, I think that we're going to see with the mystic tradition in particular, there's a recognition that the philosophical or theosophical for religion answers to evil, which are basically what? It doesn't exist. Evil as evil doesn't actually exist. It's either what we would call a hechitimsa, right? It's a necessary precursor for your choice to be able to do good, but it doesn't have any essential existence, right? Or perhaps it's a product of human failing, but is not from God. They're pretty thin comfort in the face of real evil and suffering. You know, to try to tell someone in 1492 who's floating away from the Iberian Peninsula, watching the land that they've lived in, their ancestors for hundreds of years, trying to comfort their starving children, having been completely robbed by the culture that had nurtured them for literally centuries, to tell them that there's no such thing as evil is probably not going to hold so much water. Which is why you can understand that the philosophy that we're going to speak about today, in the end of the day, will fade in the face of the Kabbalah, which comes out of the exact same generation. Because the Kabbalah is a mythic worldview which absolutely recognizes the problem of evil, if not its true existence. Yes, a number of the mendicant orders. It might have been just the Franciscans. I'm not sure if it's just them, but I'm familiar with the mendicant monks, the ones who truly took the vows of poverty and would wander and preach. That was one of their hallmarks, the cord. Yep. Don't know. There's a lot of crossover. We're going to witness the birth of the Dominican order today. I mean, not right here, but we'll talk about it. I'm not going. There's so many bad things I could say right now. Okay. Okay. Other questions or comments before we get rolling on the story? Okay. So the resurgent papacy. Just a couple of sort of points on the board. In 1205, Innocent III becomes pope in around, I think it's 1198. That's not such a critical date for us, but 1198 is after basically, remember Salah ad-Din and the Muslims defeat the Crusaders and Khatin in 1187, or something like the end of the 12th century, meaning Christendom has got a very bloody nose right now. Right? This idea that the Crusades were going to be this sort of resurgent movement, they were going to retake the holy places from the infidel, they were going to push Islam back into the corner of the Arabian Peninsula, had proven to be false at this point. And the best that they were able to fight for were these sort of 50-year truces, which kept getting violated. And this could sound familiar. This conflict between Islam and Christianity, which I encourage you to remember, is still going on, at least as far as Islam is concerned. Christianity may have thrown in the towel, but the idea that it takes two people to fight is a lie. Any parent knows that. All it takes is one to wallop the other one, and you got to fight. At this point, they're both quite deeply into the fight. For various reasons, the refocus on heresy within Europe will now become quite critical. And actually, from the end of the High Middle Ages into the Late Middle Ages, there'll be a number of continental crusades, which will shape European history in very important ways. Because it's important to remember, we often have a very broad stroke image of European history, that at a certain point, like, all the Europeans were Christians or Catholics. Now, we've already spoken about, actually, the Arian heresy and the fact that the German tribes in particular were originally not Catholics, and how Gregory the Great was instrumental in uniting Europe and Christian Europe. The date we put on Christian Europe was 800, if you recall, when Pope Leo, I don't remember which number, but Leo the something, crowned, was it third? It's always the third, right? I was going to say third, but I thought I was just making it up. Avram said it's the third, right? The key is that when the Pope crowns Charlemagne Holy Roman Emperor, and right, this concept of Christian Europe really emerges at that point, well, it is still a construct. And I said to you, if that was the beginning of Christian Europe, even though they're going to throw their memory back to stopping the Muslims, right, at Tours, but if that was the beginning of Christian Europe, the first foreign policy of Christian Europe is the Crusades, right? When they decide they're going to actually take back the Holy places from the infidels, right? But the continental crusades, call it domestic policy, of the consolidation of the both ecclesiastical and civil authority of the church, which, you know, the pope is ecclesiastical and the kings are civil, but it's a constant struggle of European history of who's really in charge, right? So that struggle will never play out well for the Jews. We haven't told the Spanish story, and like I said, we can't, but remember that the real first Crusade is actually the Reconquista. It's actually the resurgent Catholic armies that slowly march south out of northern Spain and retake, depending on who you ask, retake the Iberian Peninsula from the Muslims over the course of several hundred years. Toledo falls in 1085. That's 10 years before the preaching of the first Crusades. And that's like really the turning point of the Reconquista. Right? But today we're going to see that even in France, nominally the Catholic country of Europe at this point, because Spain's still struggling with the Muslims, even in France, the domestic policy is going to be strengthening Catholicism against internal heresy. So in 1205, Innocent III addresses the King of France in a papal bull. Right? If people are unfamiliar, the Catholic Church has a legal system similar in some sense to the oral law system we have, is that the Pope is the absolute authority, and he will issue both legal opinions as well as what we would consider to say political directives. And, you know, as is true in all cases, when you mix religion and politics, you just end up with politics, right? So here in the papal bull, I don't speak Latin, Etsi non displaciat, we're going to just go assume that's correct, he addresses the King of France, and he accuses the Jews of usury, blasphemy, arrogance, and employing Christian slaves and murder. Remember, this is after the blood libel has become, I wouldn't say commonplace, but has become an issue. And he urges the king to put an end to these evils. And the question is like, why now? What's driving the church in this sense that suddenly the Jews are the enemy? You add to this, only 10 years later, so now we're in 1215, what's known as the Fourth Lateran Council. The Fourth Lateran Council was the high point of the medieval church. It held its power until the 16th century in what's known as the Council of Trent. I mean, there were other councils that came afterwards, but this was the definitive council of the High Middle Ages, and the high water mark of the medieval papacy as a seat of power. And in it, I mean, there are many things which they discuss, but a few that matter for us. First of all, the teaching of transubstantiation was finally defined as literally the blood and body of their Savior, right? We spoke about the relationship between that, perhaps, and the blood libel, and this very strange emergence, and plus, you know, the model of martyrdom, and this very strange, almost cult of blood that seemed to circulate through religion of the day. Ooh, bad pun. So, in addition to that, there are four different canon laws, right, statements within the Lateran, that came out of the Lateran Council, dealing with the Jews. One is against usury. Remembering at this point, 13th century, the Jews have moved largely out of the commercial into the financial. Right? Even though most Jews aren't Isaac of York, they don't have the kind of capital to be lending money to the kings. They're helping the average small person with their household expenses that they need ready money for. They're more pawnbrokers than money lenders. Right? But you can imagine that makes them less popular, not more. Right? Nobody likes their pawnbroker. So one is against usury. Another is that Jews are not to be given public offices in which they can wield authority over Christians. Now, this one's a very old one. If you remember the Justinian laws that we saw back in the 6th century, it was one of the very specific things that the Justinian laws took out of Roman law, not just Christian law, is that the Jews are not allowed to hold positions of power in which Christians are subject to their authority. So that was sort of reinforced in the Lateran Council. There also, by the way, any Jew who has received baptism is to be restrained from returning to their former rite. Now, that's going to prove to be quite significant, because the question which will come up in canon law is about what? Well, yeah, they do like that question. But forced conversion.
Yeah.
Right. But the issue, meaning the issue is very rare that a Jew will sort of decide, yes, the Christians are right, I'm going to convert, and then back out. The incentives, by the way, for conversion at this point are very high. The entry into community, right? The often direct financial support which is provided for converts, right? The cost is also very high, because you're completely cutting yourself off from your past and mostly cutting yourself off from your previous community. But here, it seems the context indicates that this is a question of forced conversion. I mean, the church was opposed to forced conversion by and large. The official church policy was opposed to forced conversion for quite obvious reasons. They actually believed in their religion. So they weren't really interested in people just being somehow hopped, like it was magic, like here, poof, you're a Christian. At the same time, because they had some aspect of legal mind, they said, but baptism is a real rite. Therefore, once a person is baptized, they are actually a Christian, even if they don't believe it, and therefore, they're to be prevented from going back. This is going to have a very big consequence in the Spanish story. As Chuck said, the whole Converso story, a lot of it will revolve around this question of what do you do with a good portion of your society which has been co-opted.
This stuff around until the 19th century, that Montardo, if I recollect this name, mm-hmm.
Yes. In the 19th century story, had a very big effect in the early pre-Zionist movement, in the birth of the French, the Alliance Universelle. My languages are not so strong, but anyway, that's a story for another time. But last but certainly not least, in the Lateran Council is the Jewish badge edict, right? A very ancient tradition was reawakened and recodified at the Lateran Council. The Fourth Lateran Council, which was that the Jews would now have to wear a distinctive either yellow badge or yellow hat, which would cause it to be impossible for them to move secretly amongst Gentiles. Right? Now, first of all, it just needs to be known that phenomenon, which in our time is obviously associated with Nazi Germany, was hundreds of years before Nazi Germany, that this is the way in which Jews were kept distinct. And if you look at the writing of the law, its intention is very clear. What they were afraid of is miscegenation. They were afraid of sexual interaction between Jews and non-Jews, right? And in this, we see perhaps the earliest indications of what will eventually become racial anti-Semitism, right? Now, it will wait until Spain in the 14th 14th, late 14th, early 15th, actually, I think, early 15th century, to what are known as limpieza de sangre. I'm just mangling three, four languages today. Right, purity of blood laws that actually in Spain will demand that anyone serving at a certain position within the nobility or in the church has to prove their Catholic ancestry back four generations, which is the first actual codification of what we would consider to be sort of a racial marker, as opposed to, and these things are very important because you see what's happening in Europe now, is that the Jews up until now have been a religious problem, right? Meaning God chose the Jews from the Catholic perspective, and then God said, you blew it, I'm taking the church. The church replaces the Jews. And we've discussed how Augustine and the church deal with the continuing existence of the Jews, but the Jews remain a religious problem, as opposed to within the Roman Empire, they were a political problem, right? Where this indigestible element of empire wouldn't bow when everybody else was happy because the Romans built the roads and the aqueducts and the baths and everything else. We said, thank you, but no thank you. And we were indigestible. And it took three wars until they crushed us. And then suddenly, the church has a religious problem. Well, a religious problem, just like a political problem has a political solution, erase Judea. The religious problem had a religious solution, which is what? Well, not erase the Jews. Erase Judaism.
Conversion.
Meaning, once you convert, in theory, that's it. No problem. But we'll see, actually, when that happens in Spain en masse, it's not sufficient. And then you see the setup. You go this way. A political problem has a political solution. You erase Judea. A religious problem has a religious solution. You erase Judaism. A racial problem has what kind of solution? You erase the Jews. And so you can see already that the progression of Jewish history within Europe is building momentum. Right? And it is an important question, which I leave you with, because we're going to come back to our story for now, but within today, in the year 2019 or 5779, whatever year you think it is, what is the problem and what is the proposed solution? Right? And frankly, why do we just keep playing the same movie out? Okay, so that's a bit of the taste of the resurgent papacy, and it's going to become a dominant part of our story. That's why I wanted to lay a little bit of the groundwork for it now. But within the context of the papacy's resurgence is that domestic fight within France that I mentioned, that what's eventually going to break out in 1208 and for the next 20-plus years as the Albigensian Crusade, right? Albi is a city in Languedoc or Provence. Right? The names here are very fluid. If I had a world map, which I don't, but we can all pretend I do, right? If you can picture the map of Europe, where Spain meets France on the Mediterranean coastline, that's Provence. Right? It is an area culturally of tremendous mixture. The city of Marseille, we're talking about Marseille, Lunil, Narbonne, Toulouse, right? Montpellier, right? It's further from the coast, but what's that? I was close. Right? Maybe I'll just start writing them up on the board and you guys can read them for me. Sometimes I will go on YouTube and try to figure out how to pronounce a particularly difficult thing. You know, I didn't do it today. There were too many. So this area in Jewish tradition is known as either just Provence as a general term or Lunil. It's often just called Lunil. And there's a whole category of personalities, we'll meet a couple of them, called Chochme Lunil or Chochme Provence, depending on how you call them, the wise. And we're going to see that there's a tremendous culture of learning that will come out of here. Many people see it as the origins of the Kabbalah in Jewish tradition. And we will see that one of the great clashes between reason and revelation will have its roots right in this region at the time of the Albigensian Crusade. What was the Albigensian Crusade? It was a 20-year military campaign that Pope Innocent III, launched to eliminate the Cathars. Catharism, which the Catholic Church judged to be heresy, was, in a very simple presentation, a dualist movement. It was a dualist movement reminiscent of the Manichaean movement, which had quite a strong representation in late antiquity when early Christianity was really getting started. And they essentially believed that the good God was the God of the Christian scriptures, and that the evil God was the God of the Hebrew scriptures, right? Also known as Satan. So one could imagine that on a theological level, they were no great lovers of the Jews. At the same time, we always want to be careful mixing theology, politics, and philosophy. because they're really three different categories. It seems that the Jews of the day, in their explorations of the very problematic relationship between an imperfect world and a perfect creator, right, developed many of the early concepts of Kabbalah, right? And one of the real questions, in fact, in Western tradition, the question that mystic traditions come to answer is, how do you bridge between a finite world and an infinite creator? Right? One of the primary expressions of that is the existence of evil, right? The seeming brokenness of the world. And so there seems, according to many scholars, to have been a fluid thought between the Cathars, philosophers of their day, the sort of budding mystics within the Jewish community, some of them, right? And this was not good news for the Jews, because the other thing that was happening amongst the Cathars, right, is that southern France was nominally subject to the king of France. But in reality, there were a few very strong noblemen who either were directly adherents of the Cathar movement or simply refused to listen to the king and the pope when they were told to persecute them all that, you know, strongly. And so therefore, what the king did was unleash his most problematic noblemen. I mean, it's great, by the way. How do you get rid of all your rivals and the people that are causing trouble within your kingdom? You send them south to slaughter. And the pope said that any lands which were taken from the Cathars belonged to the people who conquered them, which was bad news for the king, because he nominally still controlled that land in the feudal system. But this means that essentially they unleashed the same type of crusade on southern France that they had unleashed on what we call the Middle East today.
Who are the Cathars?
C-A-T-H-A-R. They were a religious subset of Christianity, even though the Catholics considered them heretics. They did not see them as Christians. But they, you know, historically we place them as a subset of Christianity who held dualist beliefs, right? Which Christianity being a monotheistic religion, although, you know, we're going to start talking about the Trinity right now. But they were rejected by the church. They themselves were rooted geographically in Provence, right? Where did the belief come from? People think it might have been a Persian originally belief. It's a Gnostic belief as well, in the sense of there are elements which are about direct knowledge of God, right? I haven't done so much research on it. My interest in it has been primarily in the question of how much of what we know as Kabbalah developed in this mix, and I haven't done so much work on it. It's interesting to me that Gershom Scholem doesn't really seem to think that the Cathars played a significant role in the development of Jewish thought. He kind of brushes it aside. Right? Gershom Scholem, if people aren't familiar, is the great scholar of the development of Jewish mysticism. And a lot of his thought has been challenged, but he still laid the foundation for all the questions. So, that answer your question? So, but for our story, what matters is that in around, like I said, 1208, 1209, the campaign was launched. It was brutal. It was absolutely brutal, as were the Crusades here in the Holy Land. And perhaps the most famous event was the siege of the city of Béziers. Say it? Béziers. Okay, I'm just gonna keep flailing here. You guys will be hopefully empathetic, or you can at least make fun of me when I'm not around. The city itself originally was only around 5,000, but with all the refugees in the war, they say that estimated 20,000 people were in the city who were almost entirely slaughtered, amongst them hundreds of Jews who had taken refuge there. And of course, the famous quote, if you're familiar with it, is that there were both Catholics, Cathars, Jews, and anything else in between you can imagine the city. And the sort of famous question was that one of the soldiers worried that the breaking of the siege and the mass killing would involve Orthodox Catholics instead of just the heretics. And the Cistern abbot, who was playing a key role in this crusade, told him, basically, kill them all, the Lord will recognize his own. And that is the origin of that phrase, kill them all and let God sort them out. Right? This comes from the Albigensian Crusades and shows you, and it's very important to remember this, is that whatever role that religion may play in the development of sort of European society, and it plays an important one, power will always trump.
Mm-hmm. And the Cathars believing that we're, you know, our God is the devil. Did we live peacefully, or did they also?
And the evidence is not only that we live peacefully, but that we thrive, because we're going to see, even after the crusade was over, when the Cathars were basically wiped out, the Jewish life in Provence continued to thrive.
So even though they had this theological problem with us, it didn't show up?
Yeah, I mean, the bit I've read about it, and there's not so much written that I discovered, and trust me, if you search far enough, I'm sure there are whole books, but is that in general, persecuted peoples tend to stand together in that respect, meaning the great fear of southern France was northern France, not the Jews. Good question there? No? All right. So this, the crusade was either successful or a disaster, depending on whose side you're on, but it came to an end. And there's two things for our story that we need to take out of it, because then we're going to sort of roll on more into the internal Jewish story. That is, number one, that Dominic, known as St. Dominic by many people, was a leading personality in the early attempts to bring the Cathars back into the fold. And then during the crusade itself, in public debates, and he realized that the Cathars were quite sharp, and that only preachers, as he says, with sanctity, humility, and asceticism would be capable of overcoming the Cathars, and therefore he founds the Dominican Order. In 1216, the Dominican Order is founded as a direct result of the Albigensian Crusade, and over the next, let's say, 300 to 400 years, the Dominicans will lead the charge against the Jews in Europe. Yeah, especially within Spain. Right? The Franciscans, who are a parallel order, will have their share, but they are not nearly as militant as the Dominican Order. The Dominicans see themselves today. I actually have a friend who is a Dominican monk living in Poland. I mean, friend is perhaps, we don't spend so much time together. We are friendly and in conversation. It's very interesting because he always says to me, I still live in the Middle Ages. Right? He like lives in a stone monastery in Krakow. He's like, yeah, the cell that I live in was built in, like, you know, 1286 or something like that. Oh, my gosh. And he lives in a cell. But anyway, my point is that what he has taught me is that the Dominicans pride themselves on being the lamdanim, as it were, of the Catholic Church. They're the intellects, but they're not just abstract intellects, that they are polemic intellects. Right? Their goal is to learn in order to master. Right? And that's what came out. That's why I want you to hear, and Dominic realized that they were playing to win, and the only way to win is this combination of, I'll say it again, of sanctity, humility, and asceticism, which is why it's a mendicant order. They take vows of poverty and chastity. They own nothing. They're completely subject to their masters. Right? My friend Eric, when he comes, he's a great Ohev Yisrael, which doesn't make him so popular in his order, but whenever he comes here, he has to apply for permission, you know, not just to pay for the ticket, right, but to get non-ecclesiastic clothes in order to travel. I mean, he can travel, and he looks like Torquemada. He said it's very difficult for him. No, it's not a joke. He said it's very difficult for him looking at these pictures of the Dominicans persecuting the Jews in the 15th century because he's wearing the same clothes. Yeah, the Jesuit-Dominican fight is like, it's kind of like, you know, I don't know, I grew up in Cleveland, Pittsburgh, sort of like it's an old one. Okay, so one thing that comes out of this will be the Dominican Order, and not just in its specificity, because the Dominicans will play, like I said, a very particular role, but this idea that that the church militant, that there's an element, particularly within the monastic orders, that realize that in order to triumph over heresy, they must train themselves in the tools of discourse. Remember, this is the age of scholasticism as well, right? It's going to set the mold. I don't know your name, but Al mentioned already in the last class, the two of the great debates which really define the relationship between Judaism and Christianity in the coming centuries. And they're both held with if not specifically Dominican, I think they actually are both with Dominican. By the time we get to discuss them, I'll know for sure. But I think they are both actually with the Dominicans, if not with these types of orders. So that's one piece. The other piece that comes out of the Albigensian Crusade that's going to have a long-lasting effect is, you guessed it, the Papal Inquisition. Now, the Inquisition is an idea is as old as heresy as an idea. Just remember that as soon as you establish orthodoxy, then heterodoxy becomes heresy. Now, we have our own struggles with that as a people, so I'm not going to start like pointing fingers. But in our story for the Christian church, it was Constantine in the 4th century who put the power of the empire behind the church in his desire to create orthodox, what's called Nicene Christianity, who then launched the greatest crusade ever against Christians. Right? Constantine persecuted Christians on a scale which has never been seen since in his attempt to create a Catholic church. Right? So that notion of fighting heresy is bound up with any assertion of orthodoxy. Right? Catholic, of course, means all-embracing, which, of course, and you have to remember that that universalism is an exclusive universalism. Everyone is welcome to join. If you don't, you're going to hell. That's it. I mean, it's that blunt, right? And so, therefore, the birth of the Inquisition as an idea comes together with the birth of Orthodox Christianity. As an institution, we see in the High Middle Ages what's first what's known as the Episcopal Inquisition, which was run by local bishops. It was an institution basically dealing with problems on a local basis. But it is in 1233, as the last stage of the attempt to wipe out the Cathar heresy, that the Pope himself will create the Office of the Inquisition, which exists to this day, as empowered to fight heresy within the Catholic Church. Right? And that's a result of this Albigensian Crusade, and it's going to have a direct result at the end of our story. And of course, if anybody's familiar with the history of Jews in Spain, it has a long-term result as well. So that's a bit of the context, sort of like the socio-political, religious context within which really what, to me, is the heart of our story is going to unfold. So let's talk about Provence. Oh, questions or comments on like this sort of resurgent papacy and these internal crusades within Europe and in France in particular before we get into the Jews of Provence? Yeah, Chuck. The Baltic Crusades?
Yeah.
I will tell you, I don't know anything about it.
That was later.
It was later than this?
You mean the one about the Teutonic Knights going?
No. It was a Baltic Crusade.
Okay, we can discover. I'll look it up. Yeah, I'm sure if the Christians were killing each other in the Baltics, then there are Jews involved. I could bet. Although not at this point. If it was earlier, if it was this point, there weren't any Jews. I mean, can you imagine Latvia without Jews? I mean, like, who were the Litvaks?
12th, 13th century,
then no, I don't think the Jews were involved.
Religious wars by Catholic Christian military orders against the pagan Baltic, Finnic, and West Slavic people.
All right. Okay. There you go. Thank you. God bless Rabbi Google. Okay, the other questions or comments on this contextualization before we jump into the internal discourse. Okay, so Provence. You know, the Jewish life of Provence is very rich, and I'm not going to attempt to give you a full picture, but, you know, there was a very famous Jewish traveler by the name of Benjamin of Tudela, right? Travel diaries are one of the earliest and most important documentations of what we would today call world Jewry, right? And he reached Provence in 1165, so well before the Albigensian Crusade, and he noted that these Jews were few in number but great in Torah, and that culturally they really were a bridge between what we think of as Spanish Jewry and European Jewry at this point, which was really northern France, Germany, right, the Rhineland. But that number, that few in number, great in Torah, is important to us. I mean, we're talking about personalities, Moshe Hadarshan, who really is seen as like the end of the creative period of Midrash. Right? Rashi quotes Moshe Hadarshan in a number of places as explaining, like, the place that's coming up for me now is in when the Nisi'im bring their offerings. You know, there's 12 of the same thing, and everybody's wondering, why am I reading this? Not only during the year, but on Hanukkah and maybe on pre-Pesach too, you know, over and over the same thing. So if you look on Rashi, we'll bring you a description within a couple of places of these, like, interesting drashot of why are there two of these, and why was it this big, and the 70 of that. And he says, basically, B'shem Moshe Darshan Matzati. So you're seeing that he was really one of the last creative Midrash voices. He was there in Provence. The Radak of David Kimchi, very important in the grammatical end of biblical commentary, right? He and his father. So just a couple more names. Rav Zerachia HaLevi is the author of the Baal HaMo'or, who, if you're familiar with the Mo'or and the Milchamas Hashem, he's one of the great commentators on the Rif. Very important Rishon. Who else I have in my notes? Probably the only other one that's... I mean, there are many others. We'll get to one more in particular. But the Bala Iter. The Bala Iter is important because it was the primary conduit for the transmission of the response of the Gaonim into the later Middle Ages. The Iter is recognized really as a bridge between the Gaonic period and the age of the Rishonim. Again, just tucked away in this rich wine region. Culturally, the Jews there, by the way, many were landowners or workers of the soil, which made them very different. That was part of the Spanish culture, right? In Spain, most Ashkenazi Jews have had grilled into their mind, Jews don't own land. The Jews weren't allowed to own land. We spoke about in the feudal system how Jews were unavailable to fit into that agricultural military complex. That was true in Ashkenaz. In Spain, Jews were massive landholders. And not only massive landholders, but some of them were farmers, right? So Provence actually shares from both those cultures that the Jews were, on one hand, money lenders, although mostly really in the sort of small sum pawnbroker type, and not, like I have in my notes here, that we don't find them signing off on any of the big sort of royal loans as you would find them in, say, England or in northern France. And they were also, brokers for wheat and wine. Just to give the picture, they owned fields and even vineyards. You know, one of the most interesting things is that the enormous percentage of the Jews of Provence were doctors. In some places, they formed 5% of the Jewish working population. Right. This had a tremendous impact on the role that Jews will play in both Spain and in Ashkenazi culture. Right. I mentioned at one point that Chasda ibn Shaprut was the doctor to the caliph of Cordoba. And as the doctor, he was able to basically become his chief advisor because he was a Jew and therefore separate from the entire power structure. Furthermore, if you're going to trust somebody with your life on a medical perspective, then you're probably going to trust them to hold their tongue about your secrets. So that role of the Jewish doctor becomes both a cultural cliche and a very real source of power for the Jews in history, and Provence produces a disproportionate number of them. So you get this picture of a people very much rooted in place. Right? Unlike the Ashkenazi Jews, who, because of the feudal system, were completely dependent upon political power, they were rooted in the economy of land and place. Right? They did not play the same role of money lending, and therefore there wasn't the same sort of scale of antagonism from the power structure. And it was very clear that the Jewish physicians were treating the entire populace and not just the Jews. And, you know, again, in terms of this question of whether they were hated or not, may have helped. Although we'll see that eventually they were wiped out by riots in the time of the Black Death. But that was bad news for everybody. We'll get there when we get there. So there's a little bit of the context. I want to sort of focus in on one personality, well, two personalities in their relationship, and then play out what is a formative story for Am Yisrael. And the first personality is the Rambam, Rav Moshe ben Maimon. Right? We didn't do Spanish Jewry, and I can't go back. I really, as you notice, I keep getting like pulled back there gravitationally. But the Rambam is so foundational for Jewish thought that we cannot at least bring him into our story at this point. Right? Remembering the Rambam was born 1134 and he dies 1205. Right? Lived for just a half hour. Imagine being that productive. He is the, on one hand, in the legal sense, right, he represents that school of thought that we characterize in Ashkenaz as Rashi, that the Torah is able to be codified and completed. Right? That's why he says, right, in his introduction to the Mishnah Torah, basically, you know, you take this book and the written Torah, and you have all you know you need, all you need to know to be a Jew. That the Rambam indeed felt that he was finished, that the Halachic project had been finished, as opposed to the culture of the Tosfos, who, of course, such a thing was incomprehensible to them, right? So that's one piece, but that's only one side of the Rambam, because the Rambam wasn't just one of the great legal minds of his generation, he was also one of the great philosophical minds of his generation. And that's really where our story begins. Because if you recall, in our discussion, it was Rav Sadia Gaon, right, in the 10th century, who first introduced into Jewish discourse the notion of theology, in the sense of the need for a systematic articulation of beliefs and principles. He wrote Emunot V'Deot, you know, beliefs and opinions is usually how it's translated. He wrote Emunot V'Deot in the mid-10th century. Right? And it was Osagia who pushed this sort of Greek philosophical Aristotelian notion that reason and revelation are two paths to the same truth. And I told you at the time that he first of all, that his thought really reached its great flowering in Spain, and not amongst the Goanim. He was unique amongst the Goanim, but his impact in Spanish culture was basically unbounded. And furthermore, that he laid the seeds for a tremendous struggle going forward. And the Rambam really is the most powerful articulation within the late Middle Ages, sorry, the High Middle Ages, we'll call them High Middle Ages, of these two paths of reason and revelation, right? What the Rambam's great philosophical work is, more Nebuchim, a guide for the perplexed, right? Although it should not be undervalued that Sefer Hamada, the book of the knowledge, remember the Hei Yediyah is very important there. It's not the book of knowledge. It's the book of the knowledge. That the first section of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah is legal work. Some of it looks like it's taken whole cloth out of Aristotle and slapped on the front, which in many ways is a much more controversial act. Right? You write the philosophical book for your philosophical students. We'll speak about it in a second. And it stays on the philosophical shelf where, frankly, very few people will read it. You write one of the best-selling works of law ever, and you slap the philosophical stuff right on the front, a lot of people are going to read it, and perhaps ones that sort of ought not. All right? And this is going to lead to a tremendous controversy. This is where I want to get to, and we will momentarily. There's a tremendous controversy which erupts around the Rambam. And there is a good reason to that this very day, the Rambam remains the spearhead of heresy into the heart of traditional Jewish culture. Yes. You know, Moses Mendelssohn, who, like, if you say his name in the wrong circles, they spit, right? Who himself was an Orthodox Jew in practice, right? He was famously hunchbacked. And he said that he developed his hunch in his youth poring over the Mor Nevuchim because he'd finally found something that made sense, right? I want you to keep that image in mind as we talk about the Rambam, the controversy around him. So, like I said, the Rambam... 1204. At the end of his life, the Rambam developed a very close relationship, written with Chochmei Provence, with the wise men of Provence. And it was a result of a number of things. Remember, the Rambam, of course, is born in Spain. He flees at age 13 because of the resurgent, what we would today call Islamic fundamentalist movements. Right, the history of Spain, in a nutshell, is as the Christians advanced from the north and the sort of decadent Muslim culture in the south had a hard time holding them off, they would periodically either call in or be overtaken by Berber tribal kingdoms from North Africa who helped them hold off the Christians, but it came at the price of an intensification of Islamic culture. Right? And so when the Rambam was born, there was a resurgence. I forget if it was the Almohades or the Almoravids. I can't remember right now. But it was a resurgence of what we would, like I said, call Islamic fundamentalism, which meant that the Jews were being persecuted. And his family fled Spain for North Africa, worked their way across North Africa. He actually tried to come to the land of Israel and did not manage to stay, and ended up settling, of course, in Fustat, in Old Cairo, where he eventually became leader of the community, even though the Gaonet existed in his day. I'm not going to tell the story of the Rambam in its own right now, but it's worth it just to think about the controversy around the Rambam. A lot of it had to do with the fact that he recognized there was such a thing as the Gaonet, which was supposed to be the central authority of Am Yisrael at the time. He just didn't respect it. So as the Rambam was toward...
And vice versa.
No, it was let's just say, a rather antagonistic relationship. Right, but toward the end of his life, the Rambam, because of the enormous popularity of his thought, and recognized by everyone as perhaps the most important mind Moshe al Moshe that we've produced since Moshe Rabbeinu, right? His books received an unprecedented circulation, right? And because of that, there was a need to clarify his thought vis-a-vis his readers, and in particular of the Chochmei Provence, right? The last two letters that the Rambam wrote in his entire life were actually addressed to Rabbi Yochanan HaKohen of Lunil, right, in Provence, right, in 1199, and to the general leaders of that community in 1200. That's 4 years before he died. And he addresses them, "You, the members of the congregation of Lunil and the neighboring towns, stand alone in raising aloft the banner of Moshe," right, who he called them the saving remnant. It's very interesting that the Rambam saw Chochmei Lunil as the height of Torah in his day. Right? Now, what was his connection with them practically? First of all, many of the works of the Rambam were written, aside from the Mishnah Torah, all the works of the Rambam were written in Judeo-Arabic, which means that they had to be translated for a general Jewish audience that weren't products of the Iberian Peninsula. Right? And so his translations were mostly done by the Ibn Tibbon family, their first translations, right? Who were in, you guessed it, Provence. Right? So there was an extensive correspondence between he and his translators. Furthermore, that toward the end of his life, the Rabbi Yochanan HaKohen wrote the Rambam a list of 24 questions of challenges, essentially, to particular points within the Mishnah Torah, within his halachic work, which the Rambam put off, but eventually he did answer. And many of these letters are still in the hands of scholars today. It's a fascinating heritage that we have from the time. But probably the biggest connection of the Rambam to the Chochmei Provence is if you've ever learned the Rambam, you know that there is a systematic, it's not really a commentary, they're what are called hasagot. There's a word for that in English for sure. It's a gloss, as we call it. It's a gloss on the Rambam, written by the Ravid. Right? That's the Ravid in the third. He's Rav Avraham ben David. Right? He was one of the Chochmei Provence. There were three Ravids, so you just need to know he's the third. And the Ravid wrote a critical attack on every, I mean, he didn't attack every point, but he went through every point of the Rambam's Mishnah Torah. Right? And in addition to the halachic, and the Ravid himself was a major halachicist of his day, what's critical to come out of it is that the primary attack by the Ravid on the Rambam was that he could not stomach a legal code which lacked both a citation of the authorities from which it was taken and a preservation of the argumentation around which the point revolved. You understand? The Mishnah Torah was the first halachic work which was offered without, I mean, the Gemara says you say something b'shem omrom because it may be geula la'olam. You say something in the name of the person who said it because that's what brings redemption to the world. So the Rambam erased the whole chain of attribution. As far as you know, you're just getting what he thinks, right? And furthermore, we know that machloket, this idea that there are multiple opinions from the time of the Tosefta we looked at. If you guys remember the Tosefta, the beginning of Eduyot, which is perhaps one of the oldest Tanaitic works that we have, right? Says that we preserve minority opinions. He gives a couple of reasons. I don't go into it now. And the Rambam erased them both. So that was the number one contention that the Ravid had with the Rambam, right? That you can't freeze the halachic system. We'll see as we go forward in time that this question around codification is a controversial notion within the oral law, right? The next great argument around codification after the Rambam is going to come where? Anybody know? Yeah, the Shulchan Aruch. Right, which today, it's like, what do you mean? There was an argument about the Shulchan Aruch? I mean, like, that's the Shulchan Aruch, right? No, it was not necessarily accepted. As an important work, yes, but as a definitive codification. I'm going to make the distinction, right? Everybody agrees, yeah, the Rambam, amazing, really important. I'm going to read what he said. But is this it? Right? Because when he takes out both the attributions and the argumentation, what he's telling you is that I'm done. There is no argument. Well, who's going to argue with the Rambam, right? Right? And in the same way, the Shulchan Aruch, it was a question, was it written to be definitive? And there was no further discussion, or was it simply a student's aid for how to understand the process up to that point? Yeah?
The Ravid
wrote his Hasagot only on the Mishnah Torah, but the Ravid had a major argument with the Rambam on a number of philosophical positions as well. So we're about to get that. The Maimonidean, I can't even speak any language today, right? The Rambam controversy has four stages. We're not going to go through them all. Don't be nervous. The first stage actually happened during the Rambam's own life, right? And it revolved around, it revolved around two things. First of all, I already mentioned that how could he write at the beginning of the Mishnah Torah? A person should study the written Torah and then read this book and know the entire oral Torah, you don't need to read any other book in between them. I mean, it's just, how could you do such a thing at that point, ever in Jewish history? That was like number one. And as I said, specifically the Ravid was concerned about the lack of attribution and the lack of argumentation, the machloket. On a theological level, though, also the Rambam was what we would call a hard Aristotelian, right? Meaning what? That any anthropomorphism in his eyes was idolatrous. Right, and there's a sort of a well-known hasaga, a well-known comment of of the Ravid that when the Rambam lists amongst those who are heretics anyone who believes that God has a body, he's retroactively excommunicating a good portion of the sages of Israel. Meaning, there is a book called Shiur Koma. It's one of the earliest works of Kabbalah, of Jewish mysticism, which talks about the size of God in extensive details. And you can find many, many comments in Midrash, in rabbinic literature, about what we would call the corporeality of God. And the Rambam says, he lists in Hilchot Teshuva, when he gives his list of who's a heretic, he includes anyone who believes that God has a body. So the Ravid says, how could you call such a person a heretic? Some were greater and better than he have followed this opinion, right, according to which they found in the Bible, and even more, right, in Agadot. Like, you can't say this. I mean, there's a fundamental theological position that the Ravid sees for the Rambam is coming from Aristotle. And philosophical, remember, the philosophical notions of perfection are abstract. Always remember that in our discussion, that philosophy, in order to reach its articulation, moves toward the abstract. Right? You want principles which are non-negotiable. You might have to demonstrate through examples, but you know, particularly in the Platonic, you know, that the embodied is always imperfect. The Torah, one could argue, is not a philosophical system, but is rather an organic one. We're speaking about that notion of the Gartel. What do I mean by organic? It means that it evolves through time, and that, of course, evolution depends upon the messy physical manifestation, right? So the perfection of the organic system is in embodiment, which on one hand will always be flawed because no body is perfect, right? At the same time, the very organic nature of it allows for evolution, which allows for newness, growth, adaptation, etc. A philosophical system, in theory, once you get it, that's it. Ding. Right? And that's the appeal of the Aristotelian thought in particular. You want to say something?
But that doesn't mean the Ravid necessarily believed.
It doesn't necessarily mean the Ravid believed that, that's a good point, that God was corporeal. What he was saying is you can't call someone a heretic who says that God has a body when you look back through the Agadata and the shot in the Torah, and God stretched out God's mighty hand and strong arm over Egypt. Hey, like, you know, we know what that means. And the Rambam has fascinating, if people are unfamiliar, the entire first third of the Mor Nevuchim, of the guide, is devoted to the combat over language and corporeality. It's a fascinating work where there are very deep insights in the nature of language and divinity, etc. I don't encourage you to read it because it's the Mor Nevuchim. But if you're going to read it, it's worthwhile. What? No one argues with it today. Yeah. The Ravid lost that one.
Right.
But nevertheless, it's important to note is that the backstory here is critical. Meaning, what Avram said is true. So Ravid, on one level, wasn't agreeing with the Rambam. What's the Ravid really worried about? What was going on? Because the first controversy revolved around three things. Like I said, number one, you can't write a definitive legal work and not give us either your sources or the fact that not everybody agrees with you. Number two, you can't start swinging Aristotle as if he's the standard of measure for who's a heretic and who's not. Even if I agree with you, still you're undermining our entire sort of intellectual history, we'd call it today. Number three, there was a lot of controversy about whether the Rambam accepted the resurrection of the body as part of Tchiyat HaMetim. Eventually, the Rambam, some say was forced, some say chose, wrote a letter called Igeret Tchiyat HaMetim, the letter about the resurrection of the dead, in which he clarified his position, lest you think that such things are new to the religious world. And many people accepted that notion. But it seems pretty clear in the Mor Nevuch, I'm sorry, in the Mishnah Torah, that the Rambam is only holding by the resurrection of the soul and not the body. Right? And again, it's something which probably makes way more sense to the world in which we live, in that day was considered heresy. Don't forget, by the way, in intellectual history, one of the things that's happening at this point in history is progressive abstraction. What do I mean? If this little funny box in my hand vibrated right now, and I picked it up and started talking to it and said, oh, I'm sorry, it's my cousin, he's in China, he really needs to speak to me right now. You might think I was being rude and it was a little strange that the teacher's talking to his cousin in the middle of class, but you wouldn't think it was my cousin inside this box, and you wouldn't ask, where's China? You understand? We live in a world of experienced abstractions all the time. It's one of the things that technology has done for us. It's actually embodied abstractions. When I think about what the internet is, right? And yet the High Middle Ages was not a time in which the average person had such a clear grasp of many of the things that we take intellectually for granted. By the way, we might be wrong. I'm not saying we're more advanced, not getting into that discourse. I'm just saying that's how we view the world. We live in a world where all kinds of things we don't understand uphold our worldview, but we don't attribute them to God. We attribute them to science. Right? Anybody want to explain to me how your cell phone works? Probably not most of us. But we all believe it does. We put a man on the moon, split the atom, all that stuff. Right? Okay. So part of the challenge here is that the Rambam, because of his adherence to Greek philosophical structures, was always moving toward the abstract. Right? And yet he was embedded within a Jewish culture, which I would say, humbly, was much more oriented toward the organic. And therefore, his controversy lay in the fact that he tried to finish the law in a classic Greek fashion. We're done. Right? He tried to completely strip God of corporeality, which may be more appealing to us, and perhaps we might be true, but the average Jew then, like, what's God? Remember, Christian culture, at this very same point, was solidifying the doctrine of transubstantiation. You eat your God when you go to church. And I don't say that mockingly. It's very important to understand that in the depth of pathos which is necessary to have any hope in the face of a very evil and difficult world. Right? The only way you could do that is by literally imbibing it. And so though the Rambam might offer to our world of abstraction a much more appealing intellectual sort of, you know, sensical view of the world, there's a deep fear that what he's doing is undermining the ability to actually live within history. And we're going to see that was really the controversy. Because when the Rambam was alive, he was able to fight his battles for himself. There are fascinating letters he wrote. Rambam had one son. His name was Avraham ben HaRambam, by coincidence. Right? And so we have... Sorry, it's a bad joke. That's why nobody laughed. I just check if you're paying attention. So, and we have some correspondence between them, and he really speaks in many places, telling his son, like, you know, don't defend me from these morons. Right? Basically, he's like, I'm right, they're wrong, history will prove, and like David's pointing out, it has in many ways. But the one piece that, you know, sort of was very difficult, which in the end of the day is what erupted into the second Rambam controversy, is what's much more better known, did I really just say that? Much far better known than the first was around the Mor Nevuchim, around the Guide for the Plex. Because like I said, it was written in Judeo-Arabic. It was a three-part letter to his student, Rav Yosef ben Yud of I'm not even going to try, Kueta. And its whole raison d'etre is to try to reconcile revelation and reason. Right? The first section, like I said, is a linguistic treatise, stripping corporeality out of the very sort of corporeal language of the Torah. The second is what we would call comparative religion. Right? It brings Aristotelian thought, the thought of the Mutakalimun of his day, so the Muslim philosophers who we spoke about, if you recall, we spoke about the Kalam, right? And the Torah. You know, the third piece is I would call Avodat Hashem. Right? It's more of an inner focus. Highly worthwhile, especially the third section. Right? But it's very interesting that his student wrote to him, saying, your daughter Kima, which was apparently the name in Judeo-Arabic for the Rambam's method of reconciling revelation and philosophy. Right? The critical problem, by the way, between the two, reconciling, let's say, theology and philosophy before we get to revelation, the critical problem is prophecy. Prophecy. Because remember, Aristotle was also a theologian in the sense that he believed in some notion of God and had a philosophical system with both justify that existence and also explain the world in light of it. But Aristotle's God has no relationship to you or I. Right? Aristotle's God has no care, no relationship, no awareness in any tangible sense of the word. And therefore, there can be no commandment, no prophecy, and certainly no revelation at Sinai. Right? And so how to reconcile philosophy and revelation is really what we're after. And before I get too much into it, Because so this student, he writes to him that basically it's a very beautiful, I mean, you could read it if you want some other time, but he can't handle these two, his student. And the Rambam writes back to him, and it's noteworthy, and he says, I've written you this book. I've composed this work neither for the common people nor for beginners, nor for those who occupy themselves only with the law as it's handed down without concerning themselves with its principles. Right? He's like, I'm not interested in the legalists or in the novices. Right? This work is meant to promote the true understanding of the real spirit of the law, to guide those religious persons who, adhering to the Torah, have studied philosophy and are embarrassed by the contradictions between the teachings of philosophy and the literal sense of the Torah. And that's very important culturally, because we're going to see in a few minutes, you know what the Tosfos, you know how they dealt with this, they certainly not only had learned the details of the law, but also its principles. You know how they dealt with the embarrassment between the contradictions of the teachings of the philosophy and the literal sense of the Torah? They knew no philosophy, and they weren't embarrassed at all about the Torah. It's a different culture happening in northern France. They knew no philosophy. It literally seems that had made no inroads. And when they were arguing with the Christians, they were not in any way embarrassed about the Torah. They were willing to say, their holy ancestors had sacrificed their lives in order to keep the details of the Torah. So their stance made the Mora Nevuchim not only irrelevant, but completely foreign. What is this embarrassment that you're speaking about? So I want to explain sort of like two pieces of background, and then I'll give you the narrative in a relatively straight sense. So the first is, let's just remember, what is the problem between rational philosophy and revelation? Like, what's the issue really at hand between these, you know, and why would Rav Sadia think that you could ever reconcile them? Well, number one, remember, rational philosophy, at least in its day, was considered to be universal. It transcends all cultural boundaries. I say at least in its day because, you know, part of the postmodern discourse is actually deconstructing even logic. But, you know, the classical statement of rational philosophy is Socrates is a man. All men are mortal. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. Right? It's called a logical syllogism. You can't argue with that. That just is, right? My students upstairs will argue with me, by the way. I've had it. All right, but right. So it's critical to understand is that number one, philosophy in theory is value neutral, right? That its conclusions are not predetermined, but are the result of rational inquiry. Therefore, whatever those conclusions are, they're justified by the integrity of the method of search. Right? That's why philosophers and heretics will always go hand in hand down through history, because there's only such a thing a heretic is you have orthodoxy. Remember that. That's part of our story. That's why I started where we did. If you don't have orthodoxy, meaning there is an inviolate area of belief, then you cannot have heresy. All you have is heterodoxy, which just means, oh, that's interesting. I don't agree with you. That's it. That's all it means. Right? But as soon as you have orthodoxy, then you give birth to heresy, and the philosopher will always be the heretic's friend. Why? Because rational philosophy does not define its conclusions from the beginning. It believes that its conclusions are true because of the method of inquiry. And since that is the case, it is therefore held to be universal. Anybody, whether you're from China, North Korea, Africa, South America, I don't care. You should all reach the same conclusions. Leaving aside the postmodern problem, which has actually proven that is not true. But at this point in history, that's the way it was seen. Revelation then becomes the exact opposite. Revelation offers you its conclusion from the beginning without any method of inquiry, right? It is literally the lightning bolt. So you might develop a theology post facto to understand revelation, but the revelation itself is not a product of that theology. You understand the difference? Again, rational philosophy, its conclusions are defined by its method of inquiry. Revelation, any understanding is after the actual conclusion.
But if you believe that the method of inquiry is correct and it reaches that conclusion, then any opinion that you would derive another method
must be wrong. Yes, no, the philosophers are become orthodox like that too. That's an important point to note. is that lurking behind the sort of value neutral nature of rational inquiry is a tremendous orthodoxy. Right? Because like Dov is pointing out, if you really believe that you're value neutral and you've just reached the right conclusion, then by definition anyone who disagrees with you is wrong, right? See the persecutions of the modern era. Right? But the key is there's two pieces. Number one, unlike rational inquiry, which really begins with a method and ends with its conclusions, and the two are not sort of bound of necessity. Number two, revelation begins with its conclusions, and you may sort of backfill a theology, like how could Sinai happen? Oh, God desired, why would God choose a people? Right? Why would God want a dwelling in the lower world? Etc. All this stuff comes after revelation. It's not what gets you to revelation. So number two, revelation is by definition parochial. Right? If a person believes in revelation, let's go with Sinai. If the revelation at Sinai happened, it means that there were specific people who spoke a specific language, who were there in a particular piece of geography, who had something to eat for breakfast that morning, who had sisters, brothers, husbands, wives, cousins. You understand what I'm saying? It's parochial. It because of its embedded historical reality. Remember the organic side of the discussion, right? It is by definition parochial, right? And there's much thought in rabbinic literature around this problem. Daba Torah b'lashon b'nei Adam, that the Torah speaks in the language of humanity. Which, if you recall, we touched on the machloket of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael and what that does or doesn't mean, right? But one of the things that it's held by the rabbis to mean is that the limitations of the Torah are a limitation of the parochial, that God chose to reveal the infinite in the finite, which means that the vehicle of revelation will always limit what is being revealed. Revelation depends on language. You can't have it without. Even if the revelation itself didn't come with language, then as soon as you begin to articulate, you have to stuff it into language. And if you recall, this is also where we saw that in Spanish Jewish culture, it was the grammaticists who began that path of the philosophical deconstruction. Because if you think that Hebrew language has laws of grammar just like everybody else, you just tie God's hands. God couldn't have said it otherwise because it's a shvanach, right? So again, just to understand, the fundamental split, which Rav Sadia either didn't see or didn't think was problematic, is number one, in philosophy, it's the method which defines the conclusions. When it comes to revelation, the conclusions define the methods, which any scientist, as soon as you say conclusions define the methods, they walk out the door. What? There's no integrity to that process, right? Number two, philosophy purports to be universal, right? Whereas revelation is explicitly parochial. What do you mean? Yes, that's part of the parochialism. Yeah, it happened there 3,000 minutes in a real day at a real time, and therefore all kinds of problems of cultural relativism and historical process and transmission. Yes, absolutely. And so the question, which I'm not going to go into right now, but it's worth it for people to think about, if a person believes that Sinai occurred, as I do, why? Wasn't there a better way? Yeah, why? Why that way? Wasn't there a better way? And I'm not going to, again, we're not going to speak about it now, but I would encourage you to think about the difference between an organic approach to the world and a philosophical one, right? Sinai is the keystone of an organic existence. So this is the sort of abstract that lies behind the Rambam controversy. There's one much more specific thing to bring us back into Provence, because, you know, when Chochmei Provence, when the leaders of the community there looked around at their kids, right, they were worried. Right? Why were they worried? I'm looking for these great quotes. Here we go. All right, this is from Rav Shlomo Montpellier. Oh, right? They filled their belly with the foolishness of the Greeks. They make fun of the trusting souls. They do not enter profoundly into the ways of our Torah. The ways of alien children suffice for them. But the words of the Rambam, but for the fact that they live out of the mouth of his works, they would have slipped almost entirely. God save us and guard us, my teachers, from such a fate. Look about and see, is there a pain like our pain? For the sons have been exiled from their father's tables. They have defiled themselves with the food of Gentiles and the wine of their feasts. It goes on. Right. Well, the debate between Athens and Jerusalem, between Greek wisdom and Torah wisdom goes all the way back to the Greek encounter. Right? If we haven't done that, we did it last year here. If you guys want, you can check out the podcast if you want to hear what I have to say about it. But for our purposes now, we have to understand that there has been a sense since the time the Mishnah was codified, really much earlier, that there is the Torah and there's what's called Chochmat Yavan, the wisdom of Greece. And what it is, perhaps we'll dip into a little bit right now, but it is a long-standing fight. It's raging right now within Am Yisrael. And the second Rambam controversy is one of its heights. But what's the key there? What was Shlomo there concerned about? He talks about the Greeks, but he's blaming. What was the last line? They've defiled themselves with the food of the Gentiles and wine of their feasts. I mean, in the end of the day, an organic worldview, which is represented by the sages of France, even though he's in Provence, he belongs intellectually to the Tosafist camp, right? Looks at behavior as the touchstone, right? And we're going to see that there are three issues that the sort of anti-Maimonidean camp really had. Notice, by the way, he said, if it weren't for the Rambam, they'd be totally off the rails. So he understands that the Rambam serves a very important purpose. I call the Rambam the spearhead of heresy into traditionalism, but that works two ways. Rambam is also the spearhead of traditionalism into the camp of heresy. You know, how many university professors, right, poo-pooed religion, then suddenly discovered the Rambam, and if they didn't themselves become frum, at least said, oh, whoa, this obviously can't be nonsense if it produced someone like this, right? Those things work both ways, and it's a very important reason that in my opinion, that God would produce someone like the Rambam with all the challenges. But there were three points that the anti-Rambam camp made, and this tells you a lot about the culture of Provence, and as Dove is pointing out, it might give some insight into our world today. Number one, there was a theological argument. The philosophical camp was out there denying miracles, and they saw prophecy as a purely natural phenomenon. And the whole eschatology, the messianic vision, was, let's say, fuzzy at best with them, right? Meaning they were undermining the organic historical progress of the Torah, right? Miracles didn't really happen because the world is a system of science. And if you look into the Ralbag, if people, Levi ben Gershom, who was probably the height of this type of thinking within religious Jewry, there's a reason that there are many people who classify him as a heretic, even though he was a very important thinker, and at this point has been somewhat normalized back into the fold, but he was a product of this culture. So the denying of, again, miracles, that of prophecy as a actual revelation from a God with a will, right, and traditional eschatology, this idea of the Messiah, right, it's an undermining of the organic authority of Torah, that the Torah is a historical phenomenon meant to bring the world to its fruition. That's one. That's the theological argument, right? The number two, textual, right? That the philosophers were always allegorizing. This we know since the time of Philo, right? Those of us who've been together for a couple of years, Philo of Alexandria was a Jew, traditional Jew, right? In the second century, no. I think it was first century before. Was it second? It was first century before the Common Era. Yeah, first century before the Common Era. But the key is that Philo's great challenge was, how do you reconcile Greek philosophy with the plain meaning of the Torah? And his solution was allegory. That allegory, of course, means that there's two layers to text. There's the literalist layer, which is less significant than what he would call the intellectual or spiritual layer, which is a deeper expression of truth. Now, that is a way in which you could read a story and say, on the surface of this, this seems very crude, like the story of Samson, for instance. It's like, whoa, what's that doing there, right? And then you could abstract it to a moral. So the challenge is that Philo, even though he himself was able for himself and for Hellenistic Judaism of his day, able to reconcile this challenge, what did Philo really give birth to? A culture of people who realized that you can strip away the external meaning and just take the spirit. We call that Christianity. Right, Philo was a major contributor to the pre-Christian thought. Nevertheless, here we have, it's still a tool. By the way, it's still a tool today. And it's a powerful one, but it's a two-edged sword. Because at a certain point, if you undermine, again, the organic embodied element of the Torah, the real problem is what kicks in next. So you have the theological, you have the textual, and then last but in my mind, not just not least, but really primary, practical. Everybody looked at these guys and said, they're just not so stark on the commandments. They're eating, remember what he said, right? They defile themselves with the food of Gentiles and the wine of their feasts. Now, there's an interesting question of why these things would go together. And like, okay, we can have arguments about did miracles really happen and is revelation a natural or a theological phenomenon? We could discuss the text and Lord knows the rabbis do it too. The difference between allegory and midrash is not always so easy to define, right? But at the end of the day, for certain people, what happens there is when you undermine a traditionalist, sometimes literalist, organic understanding, then you know what happens? Well, you're sitting there at the table with your philosophical friends, and the young lady next to you, oh, you smell that perfume? She offers you a glass of wine. You say, oh, I'm sorry, I don't. Oh, you keep talking, and then it's interesting discourse and such wonderful ideas, and that perfume, and she offers you the glass a second time. It's like, oh. Next thing you know, the third time, are you really going to say no? Right? It becomes, and it's a question, as we've said here before, everybody's got to serve somebody. And if you don't know who you're serving, you're probably serving yourself. Right? And so therefore, the moralists, led by Rav Shlomo Montpierre, realized that these theological and textual arguments were a problem, but the real problem was how they bore fruit in the practical. It was in the laxity of the mitzvot, which was undermining the community, the organic functioning. We're Jews. I eat in your house, you eat in mine. We all pray in shul together, except for that guy. Because not only did I see him reading the Rambam, I saw him off there, you know, with those, you know, Cathars, doing who knows what at that party, right? And so what begins to happen is it affects the social fabric, and that's when it becomes a real controversy. And so he begins to rally the troops, right? One of his students is Rabbeinu Yonah Megironda, right? That's the Rabbeinu Yonah who wrote Igeret Tshuva, right? And I'm just going to tell you the story in brief, and then we'll hit it again on Monday as our introduction, because I see I once again am tight on time. Letters start to fly back and forth. He enlists, Rav Shlomo Montpellier enlists the Tosfists, who are more than happy to issue a blanket ban on anybody who learns philosophy, because as far as they know, nobody learns philosophy. And they're not down in Provence, or certainly in Spain. Everybody in Spain, by the way, is like, what? Are you going to tell us not to learn philosophy? Right? In this round, what happens is there's a ban, there's a counter ban. Right? Everybody's excommunicating everybody. You think this only happens today, right? And it looks like things are going to get grim, right, with a split amongst the community. But just at the last minute, this really takes off in the year 1232. The year 1232 is when these letters start to fly back and forth, and when the Tosfists issue a ban on anyone who's studying the Mor Nevuchim in the first section of the Rambam's Sefer Hamada, the book of the knowledge. 1232, if you recall, is quite close to another date that we named, and that was 1233, the birth of the Papal Inquisition. Now, there's a question about the nature of this story, but nevertheless, it's how the story is brought down, is that the papal legate, Cardinal Romanus, was in Provence in just as this controversy was breaking out, supervising the last extermination of the Cathars. So you can imagine he had no problem walloping the Jews while he was there, right? And according to one source, it was the Franciscan and the Dominican friars woke up to the religiously suspect nature of the Rambam's work, because of this intra-Jewish philosophy, and they brought the Guide for the Perplexed before an ecclesiastic tribunal. They put the book on trial. That's part of what the Inquisition does, right? It was condemned as heresy, and according to tradition, was burned in a square in Paris. Now, the shock of what is literally a Pyrrhic victory, right, for the anti-Rambamist camp, was so great that it basically extinguished the argument for that generation. Right? They just shocked. This was perhaps the first recorded burning of Jewish books by the Catholic Church. Perhaps I say because it's a poorly documented event from the pro-Rambamist camp. But tradition teaches us that only 10 years later, in the very same square in which the books of the Rambam were burnt, that 24 wagon loads of the Talmud will be burnt as well. So we're going to pick up next week with the sort of continuing cultural struggle between reason and revelation, which is not going to go away so quickly within Am Yisrael, and of course the cultural context within which it takes place.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.